Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. At the time of the bombing of Baghdad, only a handful of Western reporters chose to stay in the city and tell the story as it unfolded day by day. John Lee Anderson was one of them. He's a staff writer with The New Yorker, and his weekly dispatches telling the stories of the people he knows there helped put a human face to those at the other end of what America's leaders called shock and awe. In fact, you can find copies of his stories on our website. We're at theconnection.org. Through those days, John Lee also told the stories of the street in radio interviews, like this one on The Connection, the day an industrial strip of Baghdad was hit.
It looks as though two bombs landed on either side of a busy boulevard, blasting into the ground floor shops and first floor apartments above them on either side, and basically carbonizing several cars. A couple of hours after it had happened, the only remaining physical evidence was one man's severed hand, which was still lying out in the open, and blood.
John Lee Anderson's work sets him apart from many reporters in a war zone. He won't tell you about the injured child or the anguished mother without giving you their names, making sure that they're seen as people. For Connection listeners, John Lee is a storyteller. In this business, we call it narrative journalism. How important is that work to you as a way to understand what's really going on and as a balance to all those television images of smoking buildings and rattling tanks? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. John Lee Anderson is joining us today from a studio in Dorchester, England, and not, I don't think, with that sort of squawky sound of the Thorias handheld satellite phone that we listened to while you were in Baghdad. John Lee, welcome to The Connection.
Thanks a lot. It's a pleasure to be here, Dick.
Must be a little bit nice to be home.
Well, it is. It's both nice and strange. England, especially now in springtime, which means that it's alternately sunny, interspersed with the rain, is truly a green and gentle land, and it's a bit of a culture shock to come back from a place like Iraq here, but it's very nice.
You live in England, and you've traveled and lived all over the world, but you're an American, right?
I am, yeah. I was born in Long Beach, California, but I was raised mostly abroad, and I live here because my wife is English, but we have moved around. At the moment, we're here, but I'm American.
The reason I ask you that is that it's clear from reading your stories that the people in Baghdad, the people that you worked with, the people that you met on the street, they all knew you to be an American. And I was always struck by the way that even when the bombs were falling, even when the tanks were in the street and nobody knew whose side anybody was on, that wasn't a problem for you as a reporter. You didn't seem to get shut out, pushed around, or threatened because of your American passport.
Well, I think that says more about Iraqis. I've never felt them to be viscerally anti-Western or anti-American, even before the war. I never felt that kind of seething hatred that one does feel in other parts of the world. And for that reason, I felt very warm towards the Iraqis, and I made efforts to return there before the war. It was a place I liked. I found them to be open-minded, generally speaking, open-minded, warm, kind of larger-than-life people, a bit like the Americans, in fact.
But the part of it that I have difficulty trying to rationalize is if, you know, Boston or California were bombed by the Iraqis, and then a bunch of Iraqi journalists showed up with pens and papers and said, "So how are things?" The response of the people in this country would not be, I don't think, this sort of, you know, welcome, let's talk about it.
Sure. No, I agree. And I've always been surprised, and I was especially surprised, in fact, prepared to take it on the nose in Baghdad. The most I ever got was, I suppose, in the hospitals where the emergencies really were grievous and awful to witness and to be there. Very overwrought emotions. But even from the parents of children who had just died or of relatives who were grievously injured, the most I ever got was wounded looks, a feeling of great hurt. But never, ever, even the remotest signal that someone might have attacked me, If there was hostility, it was brooding and silent. In a few cases, never anything openly, never an accusation. You're in America, your country has done this. The kind of thing, as you say, we would, as Americans, expect to see within ourselves. I don't know quite why it is. I think perhaps a lot of Iraqis were profoundly torn between their fear and hatred of the regime they lived under, mm-hmm. and their sense of shame and desolation at being brought to the situation where their city was being bombed and their streets were later invaded by foreign troops. I think there was almost an existential kind of tear there, and perhaps that's what caused that muted response.
I mean, one of the reasons why I'm drawn to puzzle over, particularly when I'm reading your pieces, is that you as a character are front and center in stories from Baghdad, how people respond to you, how people welcome you. That's something that you choose to do quite consciously rather than sort of report from a disembodied voice. You put us with you there on the street in the hospital. Why do you do that?
If it's a conscious decision, yes, it is, it's because where I feel it's necessary to show my fellow Americans, my readers, how it is to be an American there, then I include it. And I felt that, I mean, I felt great emotion in certain situations, and I could only describe what I saw myself in my voice to the readers. And there were situations, because it was about being involved in and a witness to the tapestry of war and people's daily lives, there were times when it was best, it seemed to me, to translate that feeling to Americans. I suppose because a war like the war as it was in Baghdad until the Marines arrived, which was a war of bombardment, means that Americans could look at it as at a remove, and I know they were telespectators of it. They watched it on live television in many cases, so they had this virtual experience. But that virtual experience is so often devoid of any emotion or the gritty feeling, the kind of sensorial detail that makes you understand what it's like to be there. And in those cases, more than in most of my articles previously in the New Yorker, I think, therefore, I am present, because it seems that an American reader perhaps would relate to what I was going through, in addition to the people whose faces and names I tried to render for them.
I want to get to some of those faces and names in a moment, but just before we leave your eye and your putting us with you in places, it struck me as odd that for all your description of the whoomph of the bombs and the most horrible moments when Baghdad was under attack from the air, and you making the comment that you forgot to put your earplugs in and things like that, looking at your work over time, seems to me, John Lee, that the time on the street, rushing around from bridge to bridge, wondering whose tank was whose, was a lot scarier, was more dangerous than actually the unknown of the bombs falling from the sky.
Yes, it was. The war was up close. There was a sense of impending apocalypse, really, as the Americans began to invade the city and street fighting broke out. And suddenly these Arab jihadis, these volunteer mujahideen who had been arriving from other countries and in fact staying in our hotels, making us somewhat uneasy as to their ultimate intentions, seeing them peel away to fight, physically fight with the Americans just across the bridge, seeing the order of the city, as strange as that sounds, there was still a kind of order despite the fact that it was being bombed daily. Suddenly the tapestry, the routine that even we had become accustomed to was broken, and chaos was everywhere. It was in that chaos of the Americans arriving, the looting beginning, the sense in people's minds in the regime and amongst those jihadis that all was lost, and the idea of approaching death that made the place a lot more unsafe and much scarier indeed. You couldn't know what to expect from one street to the next. And it was somehow much more frightening and immediate than the bombs, as frightening as they were. There was almost a sense that, with a few exceptions that one had, that the bombs were going to fall, and it was, bombs are somehow much greater than one's imagination. You, in essence, you commend yourself to destiny there, and somehow fear in its most chilling form is removed from you.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, John Lee Anderson's storytelling from Baghdad gives us an insight that many other places weren't giving us. Let's take our first call now from Durham, North Carolina, and Eileen's with us. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. I'm a psychologist and a professor by trade, and read Mr. Anderson's first article about Baghdad, and just it stood out beyond anything I'd read and put me right there, to the extent that I, you know, took it to my husband and said, you got to read this. This is amazing. And then took it to work and just really put a human face on the situation beyond anything else that I've seen on the television or read anywhere. To the extent that each week when I got the New Yorker and I saw there was another article by Mr. Anderson, I thought, oh, good, thank God he's still alive, because it was so real and so dangerous. So I thank you for that. It was wonderful.
Thank you very much. It's really gratifying to hear that my being there was worthwhile to some people. I appreciate it.
Eileen, let me ask you whether or not there's a character or a moment from John Lee's reporting that sticks in your mind. I mean, I know there's several in mine. I'm just wondering if there's one in yours.
Well, I have 5-year-old twin boys, and so Ali really hit home and was very hard to read, you know, as a mom.
That's the little boy in the hospital who was badly burned and I think lost both arms. Is that right, John Lee?
That's right, yeah.
Did he live?
He lost both arms. He has lived wonderfully. He has made it past that initial 3-week period in which severely burned people evidently have every chance of dying, and he was airlifted out, received a lot of media interest in the days and weeks after I met him, and you know, he was a lucky child to have been plucked out of that. I gather he's having artificial arms specially fitted for him, but I've rarely ever seen anything so tormenting as that child's condition when I first saw him.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. It's an opportunity for you, me, and for John Lee Anderson to reflect back on the past 2 months in Baghdad through his writing, through his storyteller's eye. And we welcome your calls. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. In the brief period of time that I spent in Baghdad, one of the most moving encounters I had was with the man who was principal second violin in the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra, Majid Al-Ghazali. He's also a violin teacher at Baghdad School for Music and Ballet, and his 4 children are students there.
Yesterday they asked me what happened, and I answered them, I wish we can going tomorrow to our school, and maybe we start to clean it and prepare something, and your class.
Coincidentally, Majid Al-Ghazali is also one of the men who spent time with John Lee Anderson. John Lee's a staff writer with The New Yorker, and he's here on the program today to talk about his time in Baghdad leading up to, through, and in the days after the war. When I first read about Majid, John Lee, I wasn't sure if we had the same person, because at the time that you were writing, you'd given him a different name.
That's right. Well, I wrote about Majid, whom I called, I think, Samir, giving him a pseudonym for his own safety, in the, I believe it was the first week of the war. No, it was just before the war.
That's right, because he was trying to figure out if he could get enough gasoline to get his family out of town.
That's right. And in those days, things were really clamping down on those of us journalists who remained in Baghdad. I began to take great care with whomever I saw, and I felt it was unsafe for Majid and his children and his wife if I were to return during the war. I saw him just before leaving Baghdad. In fact, it must have been after you were there, because, of course, we were never able to find each other in that place.
No.
I was dismayed to find that Majid, although I was gratified to see that he and his family were still fine, but dismayed to see that he was undergoing real problems with a neighbor who had begun to terrorize him and his family, accusing him of being a secret police agent and any number of things. And it was distressing to me, because it was the evening before I left, and I was unable really to do much for him other than help. But he was in a state of real tension and worry when I came. There had just been an incident. That sort of thing, of course, is beginning to happen in Baghdad as people seek out channels for their vendettas in the vacuum left by the fall of Saddam. Majid, you know, for the benefit of the listeners who learned about him through your show, your program, or through my piece earlier, he felt that he was going to be able to work it out, but it seemed fairly fraught to me.
You spent some considerable period of time with senior members of the Ba'ath Party regime. I know them as, you know, through their pseudonyms in your work, because at the time when you met most of them, you still had to operate underneath the eye of the minder. But I wanted to ask you why it was that you chose to spend time with those people, because they're the ones who we were told and we've been taught to see as the bad guys in this story.
Sure. And of course, it's precisely what goes on in the minds and lives of the bad guys in the conflicts where I find so much that's revealing and of use to us as people who become witnesses to the wars that engulf the world all the time. It's in the psychology of the people that become wrapped up in these regimes which lead to wars, who have become part of systems which objectify their people and create great numbers of deaths, that I think we can learn and benefit. And I find myself, both in Baghdad and on previous occasions, trying to spend time with and understand and let these people speak their minds to me. I'm fascinated by that psychology. These were people also that it was not only a one-way thing. These people had begun to seek me out to some extent. There was that subtext in the dynamic of our meetings in the run-up to the war. There was a reason for it, and I sensed that it was because they were beginning to try to find a way to humanize themselves in my mind, in my perception, as though they were aware that things were going to change. At the most craven level, perhaps seeking a lifeline, but at a more intrinsic level, somehow trying to find the people that they were 25 years ago again, when they were young university students going abroad and before they became part of the tyranny, so that I could see them as people, as kindred souls, people like myself. And so I found our encounters fascinating, and I think ultimately the stories of those people and their transformations are the stories of tyrannies everywhere, and of and can be useful to us.
Let's take, if we can, John Lee, the example of Dr. Al-Bashir, who's in the piece entitled Saddam's Ear, which was just published yesterday. It's on the web and is also on our website for people who are interested in looking at it. This guy, stop me if I get anything badly wrong here, is a highly skilled plastic surgeon, is also an artist and a sculptor, and over the course of his time as an adult in Baghdad, became close friends, almost a confidant of Saddam Hussein, right?
That's right. That's right.
This guy chooses to spend time with a Western reporter, at times opening up to you and talking about his view of Saddam Hussein. And I'm thinking of him as you're talking to me about what's in it for him, what's in it for you. It's a fascinating kind of, I was going to say death dance. It's not, but it's a fascinating dance that he leads you on, and you as a reporter work with him on.
There was something about Dr. Al-Bashir when I first met him 3.5 years ago, which I liked. We, you know how it happens sometimes, you just click with someone else. He was different than everyone else there. He liked to talk about philosophy. He was not afraid about airing his views, which in our first meeting, I didn't agree with at all. He was a great defender of the regime, its ideology, and of course of Saddam Hussein. But it seems, and we kept up our contacts, and it was last fall, he's in Baghdad in October, several months before the war, he summoned me unexpectedly to an art gallery, and in a room there, where there was no minders, no one else listening, he spoke to me briefly and in a low voice about the fear in Iraq and the reasons for the fear, the many numbers of disappeared people.
His fear, though, John Lee, or just the fear?
He depersonalized it, but it was an extraordinary moment. I felt as though a trap door had opened under my feet, because here was a man whom I knew to be a confidant of Saddam Hussein, with an unusually exalted status in Iraq as Saddam's personal doctor and favorite artist and so on, who was suddenly confirming for me all of the things that I knew intuitively, had some evidence for, but no one else in Iraq would ever dare speak to me about them. And he chose that moment to let me have that glimpse inside of himself. It suddenly altered fundamentally our relationship, and we weren't able to talk again. And when I returned to Iraq in February, I sought him out, and we both intuitively knew when we were to speak formally and carefully, as we always did, and maintain a kind of charade. And I waited for the opportunities which he brought about, meetings at his house on a couple of occasions, where he then opened up and went further. And I began to see that this was a man who, via a twisted and perverse convergence of destiny and circumstance, had become this hesitant but nonetheless passive receptacle, in a way, for Saddam's whims, his moods, his advice, even asking him for his opinions in many cases beyond his role as a doctor. And he was trapped in this role, and he had been unable to do anything about it. Interestingly, too, I felt intuitively that the doctor had a moral predicament that he was only beginning to be conscious of himself, and that somehow in our relationship, perhaps he hoped to work it out.
Did you like him? Did you respect him?
I try not to sit in judgment of people while I'm with them, in the sense that they would be aware of it. I think I try to compartmentalize my feelings of revulsion. In the case of al-Bashir's relationship with Saddam Hussein, of course, I find that philosophically and deeply, personally repugnant. But it's too simplistic, it seems to me, to merely shut down and condemn. The very value of his experience to the rest of us is in exploring how those kinds of predicaments come about, because we are all capable of them. People get into marriages with people that eventually become ogres to them, and they live with it. We vote in our Western systems for, and we participate. We are passive and acquiescent accomplices to policies which we do not agree with all the time. Mm-hmm. If you take that to its extreme, that was al-Bashir's experience.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest is John Lee Anderson, staff writer for The New Yorker, has been filing his pieces from Baghdad now for the past two and a half months. And take our next call from Malaga in Spain. Bert is listening in online and is joining us by phone. Hi, Berta.
Hi. I would love to know what John Lee Anderson thinks about the bombing of the Palestine Hotel, where I guess 300 journalists were staying there, and quite a few, to name them a bunch.
I was horrified and outraged by it. Quite apart from the fact that I knew one of those who died, in fact, your countryman, José Cousseau, it was just an outrageous act. And if it was a mistake, which I suppose it was, I can't see any other reason for it. It was an absolutely stupid mistake. We had been obliged by the Pentagon to flee the Rashid Hotel at the beginning of the war, having been told that it was a high-value target and that the Palestine was the safe place to be. This was reinforced by the Iraqis, who also forced us to remain there. And after experiencing 3 weeks of bombings, for an American tank to sit on a bridge nearby and aim its cannon and fire at a room, and for the people that did it to later say they had no idea that that was the Hotel Palestine, seems to me to beggar belief. But somehow is consistent with what we saw in the city, whereby we saw soldiers not protecting vital institutions as they were looted, not doing the right thing. And it seemed to me that the actual seizure of the city, which included the day before the bombing of the Palestine, be consistent with
you're a journalist, right, Berta?
Yeah.
You knew the José Cousseau person.
Well, I knew better Julio Anguita, that was the other Spanish journalist killed, but while in the embedded in the yeah. U.S. Army. But I knew Cousseau also.
Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Nice to have you on the program. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. That's, John Lee, that's always a kind of a strange place for journalists to be when you're covering a war and a journalist is killed, in terms of figuring out what your role is at that point, going to the hospital. Are you put aside your pen and paper? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, it is. It's important to keep a hold of one's moral compass, I think, and remember that one is human. I recall episodes when I was younger in places and being faced with situations where I wasn't sure how to react as a reporter or as a human being. And sometimes one doesn't do the right thing. You don't do the right thing in either case.
Sometimes you can't be both. I mean, I know that sounds horribly creepy, but the right thing to do as a human being is not the right thing to do as a reporter, is it?
No, perhaps not. But I suppose it's how one judges oneself ultimately, that where it becomes important. there are cases where there is only one right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And as for the, you know, the journalists getting killed in war, of course we know it always happens. We were voluntarily there. There were those sorts of deaths that were just unfortunate, and there were those that were avoidable, and those are the ones that inspire anger because of the kind of casual way in which they were passed off. In the case of the ones in the Palestine Hotel particularly, there was a kind of almost hostile reaction by the Pentagon when they admitted that they had done it. And there was an inference that those journalists who were there in the Palestine sort of could have expected it. And this I find unacceptable.
I suppose coming out of a Pentagon warning that came some days earlier saying that nobody's safety could be guaranteed, as if under any circumstances anybody's safety could be guaranteed, never mind the journalists, the people in Baghdad as well.
Yeah.
It's always a funny, I find, kind of split. I remember working in a refugee camp once back in 91 when the Kurds were there and feeling to myself, this is stupid. What am I doing walking around with a microphone interviewing people when, you know, the kids don't even have clean water? And it was a smart editor who said to me afterwards, he said, you know, just tell the damn stories and you're doing your job. And I think at the end of the day, that's sort of where it ends up, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, there are times when you get caught up in events and you can make a difference without in any way infringing your role as a journalist. But I understand why your editor said what he said then. Your words and the testimony you could bear to that situation undoubtedly brought, you know, many more people, made many more people aware of the situation, ultimately may have helped. But there are situations we're all confronted with when suddenly we become part of the moral quandary. I have a friend, for instance, who never...
I'm
going
to stop you there if I can.
Sorry.
John Lee, just because we have to take a short break. But I want to actually come back on that point. And Connection listeners, a reminder for you, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Your chance to join our conversation, my conversation, with John Lee Anderson, writer for The New Yorker and just out of Baghdad after a long stay there. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My guest this hour, John Lee Anderson, New Yorker magazine staff writer, author of a number of books, most recently one called The Lion's Grave, Dispatches from Afghanistan. And John Lee's covered conflicts pretty well around the world over the last 20 years. He's just out of Baghdad after filing for The New Yorker from there. John Lee, on that point that we ended with, the idea of the moral compass sometimes starting to spin a little bit. I wonder if you can tell us about the moment when, late in the arrival of the Americans into Baghdad, you went back to the, I think it was the Alwiya Hospital, and found the looters there.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a case where, what do you do?
Well, there was absolutely no question in my mind. I was shocked and horrified that all of the hospitals I found to visit the hospital. In fact, this is the hospital where Al-Bashir is the director of, where he worked, and I was going there to see how he was, not knowing what I would find. Mm-hmm. I did not find him, of course. He had gone into hiding. But on the way there, I found all of the hospitals in the area. There's a corridor of them being looted and sacked and burned, and there was shooting, and it was very frightening. And I found his number two, Dr. Walid, there performing an emergency operation, the waiting room, the lobby full of dead and wounded people. And he begged me, with blood on his hands, literally operating a patient, to get help to protect them, that they had been fighting off looters during the night. I could see hospital gurneys, everything being looted from the ones around. There seemed to be, you know, it was, I didn't think. I went and I tried to get to the, I was fortunate enough to reach the Marine commander, who, once I told him what was happening, listened, focused on what I was saying, and gave the order for a squad to go and protect the hospital. And I was able to lead them there. In the 40 minutes I was away, a car had driven by shooting into the hospital. It was about to go, And they did the right thing by securing that hospital and then extending out to secure the few others that remained elsewhere in the city. But it was virtually the only functioning hospital left in central Baghdad. And I was gratified that I was able to do something, because the doctor had no means to do it himself. They were about to be overrun. He was about to lose his staff. That was a situation where I felt that it was not a matter of overstepping my invisible line in the sand that one imposes as a journalist. It was just the thing one had to do. But you know, for times like that where it comes out well, there are others where you hesitate or you don't know what the right thing to do is. I mean, I was about to tell you, and I'll just tell you that, and that's probably enough on the subject from your point of view. But I have a friend. I remember we stumbled across a massacre years ago in Uganda, and both of us found something you'd never expect to see. First thing we found upon entering this village was a stark naked woman, perhaps 90 years old, who was dying. And for a moment, neither of us knew quite what to do, and then we realized she needed water. The point is that for my friend, who is a photojournalist, he condemned himself. He never forgave himself after that little incident, which was, of course, moving and horrible for us, because he didn't take a picture that really rendered her. He didn't stand close enough to her, nor did he immediately run and get her a glass of water. And for a long time afterwards, he was never able to pick up a camera. In fact, never worked as photojournalist again. For him, that was the pivotal moment. And you never know when they're going to happen.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Next call from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Fatima's joining us. Hi, Fatima.
Hello. John Lee Anderson, I very much appreciate what you do. I am a third-generation Iraqi-American. My grandparents came from Iraq, and I am hungry for news of real human beings, of just the life there and the human part of the story in English, because I have Iraqi friends that understand Arabic and have Arabic satellite TV, and they get the human side of the story in Arabic, which I don't understand much of it. So getting it in English is very important to me. And I just wanted to thank you, God bless you, and tell you, keep doing it. Just keep telling the truth. As long as the truth is being told, that's very important. So keep doing it. I thank you. And I salute you.
Thank you, Fatima.
Fatima, just before you go, do you find that the type of writing that you enjoy of John Lee's is hard to come by?
Very hard to come by, especially since in the Arabic media, those stories are told like maybe two days before. Like, there's information that comes out in the Arabic media 48 hours before it's in the American TV. So it's very important to get it in English.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255 to Boston now. Deborah's with us. Hi, Deborah.
Yes. I read last night while I was falling asleep John Lee Anderson's article about Dr. Al-Bashir. And I wanted to ask you, Mr. Anderson, it seems to me that you, as he said, are fascinated with questions of moral ambiguity. And you devote a lot of time to probing the psyche of these individuals who are perhaps part of the power structure, yet still subject to the whims of a terrible person who's liable to kill them or torture them for expressing the wrong opinion. And I'm just wondering if it feels to me a little bit like you have bought into some of the moral superiority that we Americans always seem to claim. We don't seem to have any doubts about the appropriateness of our going into Iraq and causing terrible havoc and destruction. And yet we are looking with a very fine eye at individuals who are caught in circumstances not always within their control.
Well, it's true that the Western press has the freedom to probe and examine every facet of Iraq and its past, and even its moral ambiguities, as you point out in my that I did in my piece on Al-Bashir. But I would say that the pieces that I wrote during the war, in which I was a witness and wrote what I saw, which was, after all, the effects of the American war in Iraq, in the horizon line around me, are sufficient witness to the moral ambiguities you point out. I was witnessing, after all, as an American, what it was like for Iraqis to be bombed by Americans for an idea that not everyone had bought, which was that it was about weapons of mass destruction or it was about regime change, whatever it was about, that's what I was witnessing and that was what I was writing about. I don't think I have bought, certainly not consciously, into the idea of any moral superiority. If I had, I probably would have decided to go with the American troops rather than be in Baghdad.
Deborah, thanks for your call. John Lee, Kareem, the barber, did you get a chance to drop in on him before you you left the city? I notice he pops up several times, either because he's a favorite of your driver, Sabah, or you need a shave at some point while you're overseas.
Well, really, I like Kareem. Going to Kareem was a way to one of the few ways, possibly the only way I had to really relax occasionally. I'm not one of those sort of punctilious people who goes for a weekly shave and a haircut. Eldo Sabah, my driver, does and has done so with Kareem for 30 years, and he loved nothing better than to take me there so we could both be pampered by Kareem in his dingy little barbershop. I did go back and see him again Friday before last, just before leaving Baghdad, but not at his shop. There was no electricity in his part of the city yet, and so he came to my hotel room and performed his artistry on me there, as a result of which I have one of those Uday Saddam Hussein cuts, this very short hair, which is fairly unaccustomed for me, but which pleased him no end. So he was fine.
Now, you've reminded me of Uday, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about was that the moments, time that you spent walking through the marbled compound that had been home to Uday, the place with its own dental clinic and its own beauty salon. Because I have to tell you that there's a point at which, as a consumer of these images of opulence, they all mush together. And I'm curious to know, now that you're away from it, now that you have a sort of a little bit of distance from that, what you remember, what sticks in your mind from, you know, spending just that short a period of time that you did walking through the detritus of that place. It's so bizarre.
Yes, it is. I don't know. I suppose the most eloquent thing was the refrigerator in the bedroom of one of the sisters. This was actually the family compound, I realized later. There was a house for each a member of the family, including Uday, who of course had many places, like his father. He didn't really have a fixed abode. And there were six or seven identical, expensive French wrinkles. It was like a wholesaler's view into these people's lives. Clarine's anti-wrinkle cream, Clarine's night vision cream. I don't know the names of all of these things, but
somebody
there was a refrigerator with
a duty-free store.
with a half a dozen of each of these things in it. I don't know. There was a sense in these places that it was more or less what one expected, people without a great deal of taste but a lot of money, they had created a kind of gilded prison for themselves. That was very clear. I recall very much looking out at the Tigris River from their mansions and realizing that they were as caged in as they were caged out. There was very high steel-pointed barriers between them and the river, and I thought, what a bizarre, strange, royal but clandestine existence they lived in their own country.
Once you get to spend a little bit of time in that damp green countryside that you're in right now, are you thinking that you have a trip back to Baghdad coming up in the future?
Yeah, I it's very hard to let go of. Just yesterday I had a call out of the blue from Ayatollah Hakim's assistant, whom I got to know in Iran, and they were wondering where I was. And it reminded me that, oh yes, the whole Shia phenomena, which is such an important factor, and so on. I would like to go back with refreshed, you know, with a refreshed mind and look at what's happening, look at the American occupation of a foreign country, of Iraq, for what it is. But I needed to leave in order to do that. So I would like to spend May at least just relaxing and with my family. And perhaps in June or something like that, I might return, maybe July.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I need you to just sort of wrap for me on a little bit on this, John Lee, about what works in your mind as a journalist when you get a chance to go back and back and back, because people who will have read your dispatches will know that this wasn't just a 2.5 month stint, but the latest in a number of stays, and as you say, more to come. What do you get out of it as a storyteller, and what do we get out of it?
Well, I guess I get out of it this. It's like opening up a treasure box of history, of mythology, of other people's realities, and learning from them, and hopefully transmitting that other reality, which is a reality. I respect their lives, and I think we should know them because we have become perversely so intimately linked in a collision of war with Iraq. I think it's important that we see this country and these other landscapes where we go as human ones. And that, to me, to be given the opportunity to tell those stories in a way that people find interesting is incredibly enriching.
John Lee, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
John Lee Anderson, staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.